Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Today's topic is jazz, and our featured guest is the quintessential jazz man. He's Christian McBride. McBride is the winner of the 2011 Grammy Award for Best Large Jazz Ensemble. Akura Holt has our special interview session with Christian McBride.
I'm Akura Holt. Today on Like It Is, Jazz Spaces composer and arranger Christian McBride.
New John, The Good Life, released in 2023.
If we could somehow balance the scales, that's better for jazz. People can focus more. People can embrace what is hot culturally in terms of pop culture, but then also understand that art, great art, is very crucial to not just the intellect, but to our spirituality as well.
Christian McBride. He has appeared on more than 300 recordings as a sideman and is an 8-time Grammy Award winner.
Hi, Christian. How are you? And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Akua. It's a pleasure.
There's so many questions that I could ask you about your work, but one question I won't ask you is what Ron Carter said to someone, don't ask what is jazz. So you won't go there, right? Because here we are in the 21st century and that question has been answered, no doubt. I'll pass that one up, but let me ask you this. When did this music call you? When did you know? Were you in the womb? Were you a kid?
Probably. I mean, I have a family full of musicians, so I feel like, yes, I probably was called to the music in the womb.
How early did you start playing?
I started playing the electric bass when I was 9 years old, and I started playing the acoustic bass when I was 11 years old.
Was this just something you were drawn to, or were you directed to play?
No, I wasn't directed at all. I watched my father play. He's one of two musicians in my family. At the time, he was playing with the legendary Cuban percussionist Mongo Santa Maria. Wow. And so I grew up watching my dad play with Mongo quite a bit. For whatever reasons, this one night, I decided I wanted to try to be like my dad and play the electric bass. And after that, it snowballed.
Did you continue to study through high school and college?
I grew up in Philly, and I went to a high school called Creative and Performing Arts, also known as Kappa. And my best friend in high school was the late Joey DeFrancesco. The Roots went there. Questlove and Black Thought went there. Boyz II Men went there. Kurt Rosenwinkel went there. It was a school full of incredible artists. Now, I'm not even mentioning all of the singers and dancers and actors and creative writers. It was really a special place in a special city. So after high school, I moved to New York to go to Juilliard to further my classical studies. And I only stayed for a year because I wound up working.
Was that around the 90s?
1989.
And you said you only stayed at Juilliard for a year?
There for a year, because I started working with Bobby Watson. And soon after that, I started working with Roy Hargrove. I actually already knew Roy, and Roy's career was really starting to get going. And so I went on the road with his first band. Not too long after that, I started playing with Freddie Hubbard. So that first summer in New York, things started to slowly take shape.
You're talking about all the musicians that I love. Sometimes I think, Christian, maybe the creator didn't make me a musician, so I can appreciate you guys. I love the music so much, the genre, everything about it, the people, the stories.
We need the listeners and the people who appreciate it.
I see you walking in the footsteps, Christian, of all of these giants. You're one musician that seems to take in these life lessons that have been passed on to you. And it seems to me, just watching you, I don't know you personally, but just watch how you move through your audiences and your performances and the way you connect with the music. You embody all these people that have impacted your life.
Thank you. It's been very important for me in my career to spend time with the elders. That's how you get this music the proper way, you know, and I love the fact that jazz education exists. I've been deeply involved with jazz education, but when you actually spend one-on-one time with the masters, and they oftentimes don't give you information, they often give you code, they just give you examples, and you're supposed to figure it out on your own. That's really the true way I think you learn this music. Being around people like Randy Weston and Betty Carter and Freddie Hubbard, Joe Henderson, McCoy Tyner, I've always taken that more seriously than anything else. I want to learn the lessons directly from the people that gave us that great feeling of strength and enjoyment through their music.
I heard Ron Carter say on his documentary, someone was asking him, was he finished? He was pondering upon entering his 80th birthday. And it seems once he got past that point, he realized there's much more to say, much more to do. And I don't quite know yet, but I will know as long as I keep doing.
Yes, he's gone full throttle over the last few years. It's very inspiring to see. Even through the pandemic, Ron was still pretty visible.
And so were you. And I really appreciate that. You guys were there, you were present, you were connecting with your audiences and your fans. And I just think it gave people hope because folks were really afraid, didn't know what to do, who to turn to for inspiration. Right. And the news wasn't very inspiring, but it was the truth. The pandemic was scary. It was important that we knew all the details. And when I watched your pieces that you presented during the pandemic, that gave me hope.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to
Jazz Spaces composer and arranger,
the one and only Christian McBride. Christian, let's talk about your role or your involvement with jazz education. You mentioned something about that earlier in our conversation. Do you see that the children, the young people rather, are they receptive to the music still? Or is there a disconnect because of the new genre of music? Hip hop has been around 50 years, but we know jazz has been around just as long.
Much longer than that, yeah.
Much longer. And then the language is the same. One is spoken, the other is musical. There's no separation between the two. Do you see that young people are evolving to understand the connection between the two genres?
It's a mixed bag. Like I said, it was important for me to be around a lot of the elders and learn directly from them. I find that when you expose children to jazz, it's a win-win because you can't just sit a child or even a person who you're trying to get into the music. You can't just simply take them to a classroom and they can learn about this music in school. It's only half of the job. They have to go out and experience live music. They have to be able to see this music being created in front of them. And because this culture, it has such a visual aesthetic, people do more watching than they do listening, I feel like. Once you take kids to see live jazz, they might not like it at that moment, but I feel like it's 100% guaranteed that at some point, as they get older, those experiences are going to start seeping in. It's like a delayed effect. And then the other half love it instantly, and they want to see more of it. They want to hear more of it. They want to learn more about it because they just simply haven't been exposed. So those of us that know about this music need to hold the hands of the younger people coming up and say, hey, I'm taking you with me to see a jazz concert.
This connects with me on a spiritual and mathematical level. Now we're talking about how many times a person is exposed to make the impression. In social media, they're always talking about, well, how many impressions did your post make? What you're saying simply is that when young folks are exposed to the music, there's an impression that's made there. Sometimes you don't have to use words. You don't have to talk.
That's absolutely right.
We just have to expose them. And with music being taken out of the schools and children now have to compete to go to a performing arts school, then you leave a nation of children who may not make the cut. Their only exposure is church if they are still involved in the church. A lot of our musicians back in the day, and even still today, were rooted in the church.
Talking about something now.
Yeah, I remember my sister played the flute. I wasn't musically inclined, but I did other things. I always loved showcasing artists, even as a young child. I just knew that's what I was supposed to do. And when I got older, my mother told me, she had an aunt who used to bring James Brown and all these people to a very small town in Beaumont, Texas. She owned a performance hall.
Actually played in Beaumont, Texas once.
Is this what inspired your wife to create the jazz organization for children?
Exactly right. Like 23 years ago, she was asked to do a master class for some elementary school kids. And there's no tougher an audience in the world than elementary school kids. At that time, she had no experience in doing workshops or master classes, particularly in jazz. She thought on her feet. She said, what kind of theme can I come up with so these kids will be interested in the music? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, let's build a metaphorical house using jazz instruments. That's how Jazz House Kids got started. She wound up enjoying the experience so much, and apparently so did the kids. She decided to start a whole organization based around jazz education.
And that organization, Jazz House Kids, is now a nationally recognized community arts organization. Yep. And founded by your wife, Melissa Walker, and it's exclusively dedicated to educating children through jazz. And the Jazz House concept brings internationally renowned jazz performers. I wonder if one of them is this guy named Christian McBride.
Well, you know, when I first started seeing Melissa, Jazz House Kids was just getting started. You know, she was just getting it off the ground. She said, why don't you help me build my foundation? I said, I would be honored. And so she named me artistic director. I do whatever needs to be done. I'm artistic director. I'm director of transportation, custodial department. Yeah, whatever I need to do, that's what I do.
There was a master muralist in Houston. He's since made this transition, Dr. John Biggers. When I spoke to him once, he said to me, artists, they're the spiritual antenna of humanity.
I like that. I like that.
That's you, Mr. McBride.
Oh, from one antenna to another, I'm flattered. Thank you very much.
I'm not saying it to flatter you. I'm saying this because your track record speaks for itself. Sometimes in the world that we live in, most people think that, hey, you got to make it so you can make a lot of money and make a lot of money and buy a lot of things and do these external things in life. But it seems to me early on, you understood and had a commitment to share your gift with humanity, whether it's Jazz House Kids. I've seen multiple videos of you instructing young people how to play the upright bass. I wish I was one of your students. That's one of my favorite instruments. I've always loved the bass instrument, or impressed is not the word. It is heartfelt to see you doing this work. No, I've got to say it because Randy's gone. And these are just some of the things that he instilled in me as a human being, not just as an artist and a performer. And he wanted me to understand that's our job. It's not even work, that's our calling. And when you get into this and you understand that level, then you touch humanity everywhere you go. And as you mentioned earlier, that impression is there.
Yeah. That's right.
Help people evolve along with this music. You're listening, but you're actually getting this spiritual bath, right? You pick up so much toxic energy out there in the world.
Man.
There's so much going on. And then you sit there listening to Ron Carter or Randy or whomever, and you know that you can step into another space and time. And that's what Dr. Biggers taught us. He said, the artists, they allow you to step into another space of time. You might want to use that for your next album. That's where you're taking us. I feel that in your music. I'm just in the audience. As I said, I love it. I can't play it.
If you find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find Like It Is on the NV1 app for Android and Apple. You're listening to the Public Affairs program, Like It Is. I'm Bob Franklin. Grammy Award winner Christian McBride is our guest. Akura Holt continues the interview session.
Christian McBride is with us, and he is the current host of the Lowdown Conversations with Christian on Sirius XM Satellite Radio with National Public Radio's Jazz Night in America. This is a weekly radio show and multimedia collaboration between WBGO, NPR, and Jazz at the Lincoln Center, showcasing outstanding live jazz from across the country. And with his staggering body of work, McBride is the ideal host, drawing on history, experience, a gift for storytelling to bridge the gap between artists, music, audience, and this thing we call humanity.
I'm Akua Holt. Today on Like It Is, jazz bassist, composer, and arranger Christian McBride.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your activism, because arts and activism, not everyone embraces that. There was a piece here in 1998, you combined roles composing the Movement Revisited, which was a 4-movement suite dedicated to 4 of the major figures of the civil rights movement, Rosa Parks, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The piece was commissioned by the Portland Arts Society and the National Endowment for the Arts and performed throughout New England in the fall of 98 with your quartet and a 30-piece gospel choir for the 10th anniversary. The Movement Revisited was expanded, rewritten, and revamped to feature an 18-piece big band and 4 active speakers in addition to the gospel choir. That's next level, Christian. Tell us about that experience. That's a major production.
Yeah, it is a major production. I don't get a chance to perform it very often because, as you read, there's a lot of bodies on stage. Yeah, so it had this international premiere in Toronto. I really love playing this piece. Growing up as a kid in Philly, my grandmother used to save huge stacks of old Ebony and Jet magazines. And my mother and I used to tease her, asking, you know, why didn't she throw these dusty old magazines out? These are from the 60s, you know, 50s and 60s. Why would you keep all this stuff? And after a while, I started reading them. And I got so deeply entrenched in old Ebony and Jet magazines, I started learning about Black history as much from those old magazines as I did from books, documentaries, stories, things like that. I would read about things that happened that were historic, but I would find the magazine covering the story when it was new. So I was reading like contemporaneous writings on things that were now historic. Things like the coverage of Martin Luther King's assassination, or coverage of Rosa Parks, of the Montgomery bus boycott. When Martin Luther King was arrested in Birmingham and he wrote that now historic letter from Birmingham jail. So things like that were very important to me growing up, and just to see what was important in the Black community in the 50s and the 60s and the early 70s. 4 people whose legacies really connected with me for different reasons. I don't even know why it was these 4, but I really got into Rosa Parks. I really got into Martin Luther King. And Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali. Obviously, everyone loves Muhammad Ali as a boxer, but the real true fans of know him for much more than simply boxing. So when I wrote this piece, I think I chose the wrong words, because I said this was my musical portrait of the civil rights movement. And that's not exactly true, because we all know there were a lot more people than just those 4 who were crucial to the civil rights movement. It just happens that these 4 people occupy the world at the same time, fighting for the same cause in different methods. From a younger person, yeah, okay, Rosa Parks and King represented the SCLC, and Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali at one point were together at the Nation of Islam, which was much more vociferous and radical. But I never thought that they should be thought of as separate. You know, so I talked to some older people who thought they should have, like, you know, you can't combine them in the same piece when you're talking about the civil rights movement. I found that interesting. So, like I said, I want to know what the elders think. Instead of calling it a portrait of the civil rights movement, I just call it exactly what it is. And that's a portrait of 4 icons.
That movement, even though there was an era, it's still fluid and it's still evolving.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, and it came from somewhere. It was rooted in something. Each one of those icons you mentioned, they all have a different story. Like, for instance, I was surprised to find out that Rosa's family, they were activists themselves and was already doing activism work before she met Dr. King.
Right.
But that's the narrative that we got, because again, now that the information is widely available, that's probably why she was chosen. Very important piece to note in the genre of jazz to have a weighty piece like that on the books for young people and just for humanity to visit in the future. Can you tell me about your comments that you made to
President
Clinton, I believe, about jazz?
I was invited to sit on a panel that he put together.
1997. On racism in the performing arts.
Yes.
You had some things to say about that. Was it related to funding or the fact that the arts is not readily available?
No, it was a general conversation. Bill Clinton had put together a task force, various task forces. One of them involved speaking of the different isms in the world of the performing arts. We were talking about all of the arts, not just jazz, but dance, acting. I sat on this panel with George Takei, Dr. Sulu from Star Trek, Angela Yee. Who else was on this panel? Oh, Garth Fagan from Garth Fagan Dance.
Oh, yes.
It was an amazing panel. In retrospect, I had no business being on that panel. I was 25 years old at the time.
Well, they probably wanted to hear some younger voices.
I did the best I could.
Yeah, but you were representing an entire demographic.
Right.
So yeah, it doesn't mean that you needed to have all the answers. I think showing up at the table and being part of the conversation, that's how we get things done. Christian, as you move through this world, being who you are, touched by all these jazz giants and greats, including your own family legacy, if you had to dream a world for jazz music, what would it be?
I feel like there was one point in time where jazz was the dominant music of the streets. I know that fads come and go, things change. Whatever the young generation finds interesting, that's what's going to dominate the sort of the common denominator. And I just wish people could be exposed to jazz more, because there's no way in the world that they would be exposed to it and not like it. You know, I hate to see our jazz legends who have had to struggle, poor healthcare, poor career support. I would just like to see a world, well, specifically, I would like to see our country more interested in things that aren't pop culture hot. I would like to see a country where we read more than simply the headline or the tweet. We're less driven by who likes what we put on our social media page and worry about what good we're doing in the world away from our iPhones. We've gotten so stuck having our lives online. And someone said that life is now a spectator sport in America. So yeah, I would like to see it, because if we could somehow balance the scales, that's better for jazz. People can focus more. People can embrace what is hot culturally in terms of pop culture, but then also understand that art, great art, is very crucial to not just the intellect, but to our spirituality as well. A country where we support jazz more often, visual art more often, poetry more often, dance, and I'm not talking about only hip-hop dance, I'm talking about classical dance. There's so many different ways that people express themselves artistically in this country. I would love to see it not be so determined by what's hot.
Thank you for what you do, brother. Thank you. You are a gift to us.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Please shout out to your wife, Melissa. Thank her for the work that she's doing. I'd like to talk to her in the near future.
Sure. And,
Christian McBride.
It was wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you.
jazz bassist, composer, and arranger Christian McBride.
Neil John, The Good Life, released in 2023.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, for Like It Is, I'm Akua Holt.
Akua Holt is our Houston, Texas-based reporter-producer for Like It Is. The guest today was Grammy Award winner Christian McBride. If you find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you and want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.